it's something that's so positive. It should be so positive, son. Of course, we want to live in a society where everyone gets the best education possible, where they're able to live up to the best of their ability and to contribute to their fellow citizens. And the way the colleges have structured this market does everything but. It's no longer essentially about education. It's a lot about status and signaling. It's no longer about affordability. It's about exclusion and debt. And all of these things are so deeply perverted compared to if you think back to, some of the founders of these schools and what they would have wanted.
Welcome back to the Joe Mobley Show. I am Joe Mobley, your host, and still the original uncloseted conservative. Guys, as always, we are presented by Osh Career Consulting. OshWorldwide.com is the website where you can get career coaching from this guy, the one and only Joe Mobley. Guys, pivots don't have to be hard. I've pivoted more than five times in five different industries and had a wonderful career. And here I am in pivot number six. As a culture commentator, which is still the most nutso thing to me. But you can do it too. 8 out of 10 Americans hate their job. It's a ridiculous statistic, guys. Walk away from the career you hate and into the career that you love. I can coach you through the links or below if you want to get on a strategy session and see what the plan would be for you. Guys, we've got an awesome interview for you today. Wherever you're watching, wherever you're listening, we are in the year of the podcast. The podcast is everything. I am not rebuilding another YouTube channel. That's not true. I put clips on YouTube, but you guys know my YouTube channel got canceled. We push podcast all day, all night. So open up the app. Whatever you listen to, wherever your podcasts are, open up on your phone, search The Joe Mobley Show, and like and subscribe to the show. If you leave a review, remember, it's not just a review. Oh, Joe's so great. Sahaja's so great. No, you got to leave a review of something that you learned, enjoyed, something that excited you about this interview, and you will be entered in for a chance to win the free monthly book. Guys, I'll be sending that your way along with some Joe Mobley Show goodies. But before we get into that, let's get into this. We are talking about the elite colleges and universities of our nation. What's going on with them? Guys, it's a favorite topic of the show. We've had many, many, many great guests. Today's guest is no exception. Please welcome Sahaj Sharda to the show. Sahaj, how are you doing, my man?
I'm good. I'm good. I'm happy to be here.
Good, good. Well, Sahaj, I've read your bio. Obviously, the listeners haven't. So tell us about yourself, and we'll dive in.
Great. Yeah, so my name's Sahaj Sharda. I've spent a lot of the last year researching and writing a book that's finally going to be coming out in March, titled The College Cartel. And the broad thesis of the book is that elite colleges have all sorts of problematic policies when it comes to admissions, when it comes to spending, when it comes to tuition. But behind all of that, I argue that it's the market structure that's deeply broken. The reason the colleges haven't actually fixed themselves, the reason that things just seem to get worse and worse in higher ed, is because there's virtually no entry. No one can come in and compete. There's this weird combination of government subsidies and regulatory capture, which keeps other entrants out. And it's a subversion of the free market principles that make other industries better year after year. In the case of the elite colleges, the monopoly power has gotten so strong that they're able to squeeze everyone else out. And the net result is high tuition, high prices, scarcity of seats, and unbelievable subsidies that are lobbied for and extracted from the taxpayer.
See, now that's a really interesting framing, because most people know that something is broken, not just with the college system, but particularly the elite colleges out there. The famous ones, everyone's heard of them. They're the Ivy League and then the near Ivy League universities and colleges. I've always thought this is the schools doing this, getting, with these inefficiencies, these policies and processes that just don't work or make sense. And honestly, some of the stuff that your team sent over was some of the first stuff that I read that was like, oh, wait a minute. There's a, everyone talks about the corporate private partnership. There's a college, there's a college and government partnership happening here. So talk to us some about what's going on with the elite universities and their relationship with the government.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question because I think, you know, the common framing is that it's the government that's empowered the colleges through, you know, cheap credit for if you want to take out a loan to go and get a degree.
And I've said that on this very show. And like I tell people, right. Happy to be wrong. I love learning stuff from my guests. That's why I do an interview show.
Right. Well, so look, you're not 100% wrong either. I mean, there is a story to be told where the government's empowered the schools. I think specifically, you know, the theory of the late 60s under the Johnson administration was essentially that, you know, we need to invest in, I think, what they termed human capital, or has at least subsequently been termed human capital. This idea that people, by investing in themselves through higher education, become more efficient and productive people who can contribute to the economy in ever better ways. So that is one theme. But I would posit to you that that happened a very long time ago. And actually, since then, the relationship has actually flipped. It's no longer the government that is empowering at least the elite colleges. Indeed, it's actually the elite colleges that have completely captured government. The power relationship is actually flipped entirely. And so what happens now is the presidents at the elite colleges essentially get whatever they want from our Congress. When they want to lobby for more subsidies, for more tax breaks, for more research grants, they get what they want. When they want to lobby for more ability to essentially, you know, be these massive hedge funds that are so disconnected from the enterprise of teaching, they're allowed to do that. And I think most importantly, when they lobby for things like antitrust exemptions so that they can collude amongst themselves to fix prices or to fix quantity, they get that too. And this is all in the public record. You know, in the end of the Reagan administration, beginning of the first Bush administration, there was a lawsuit that was filed against the elite colleges. It was called the Ivy Overlap case. And what had been happening essentially was since, you know, essentially the 60s, the Ivy League schools would get together in the spring and they'd all bring like a common sheet of like all their admitted applicants. And then they would go through it name by name and see who else had admitted that student. And by doing so, they then started conversing about how much financial aid all of them would offer, trying to standardize as much as possible so that there was no variation in price. Now, this is the exact opposite of a free market, right? Essentially, in a free market, you don't collude with your competitors. You try to cut costs so you can eat their market share. The schools were doing the opposite starting in the 60s. And they're allowed to do this all the way to the 90s. The DOJ files the case. And then what happens? Well, two things happen. Number one, what happens is that MIT refuses to settle with the Department of Justice. They go to court. And MIT in court says, basically, you know, we're a nonprofit. And so you shouldn't think of us as a business. And so therefore, the antitrust rules shouldn't apply to us, which I think is a farcical argument. I mean, at this point, I don't think anyone truly believes that the elite colleges are not in the business of education. You know, for them to frame themselves as charities, I think is deeply disingenuous. But then the second thing happens, which is that the other eight Ivy League schools, which had settled, go to Congress and have Congress write them an antitrust exemption. It was called the 568 section of the Higher Education Act. And essentially, this allows them to legally fix prices. And they were allowed to do that all the way up until 2022, when there was finally a class action lawsuit filed against Yale, Georgetown, and 17 other elite colleges, which, you know, if it's successful, may claw back up to billions of dollars back for students, which were wrongfully taken from parents through these collusive practices. And so I think, you know, there's this story that hasn't been told so much. You know, like I said, the thread was they started doing this in the 60s. It went on till the 90s. And then it restarted and it's going on till 2022. And if you look at the mainstream media, they've been essentially silent on this. When I was researching the book, I was so curious, you know, the exemption had to be renewed every 7 years. And so Congress would debate it. But there was essentially no coverage by the mainstream media of these types of collusive, anti-competitive practices for the longest time. Up until this lawsuit, no one had covered this. And I think because the media was asleep at the wheel, you could see essentially the elite colleges capture Congress in this way and then start to act in these super anti-competitive monopolistic ways that were so detrimental to the entire country. Because essentially what happens in the college market is the elite colleges set the standard. So when they jack up prices, that creates a trickle-down effect where everyone else is also able to jack up prices over time. And the net result is tuition inflation is through the roof. It's not even comparable to any other kind of inflation. And it's depriving middle-class families of a very important avenue for advancement and for self-improvement. And I think it's so, so wrong.
One of the things that I just wasn't tracking on at all, and you said it in the beginning with your open, and I'm sure that your book goes into it in greater detail, but I had always assumed that it was kind of a zero-sum game with elite institutions. They've got this many seats. And going through some of the literature that your team sent over was the first time that I even heard the idea of artificial scarcity of seats at a program like this. So definitely talk to us some about that and what that's all about. Is it a pure money play, or are they able, by doing this artificial scarcity, because they're playing to the formula of basic economics with supply and demand, is this right. How they're able to write their own ticket with the government who's subsidizing and then the taxpayer who's doing whatever they can to get into these institutions?
So, you know, the basic cartel theory is essentially, and, you know, if you look at OPEC or even Escobar, I mean, essentially criminal enterprise or regular business, it's always the same. The idea in a cartel is to restrict supply so much for a much needed product that people will be willing to pay essentially whatever. It's a form of blackmail. And so when OPEC, when Saudi Arabia and Russia and Venezuela get together and decide to cut output, this is what they're doing. They're holding the American hostage at the gas pump. And this is exactly what the elite colleges have done too, because what's happened is, you know, after World War II, there's a brief window of about 20 years, 30 years, where Harvard and Yale were growing like crazy. They were both competing to be the biggest colleges in America. And then something switched. And what they decided to do instead was stagnate their enrollments. And so if you look at like the growth of the number of seats available at these schools, it's essentially flatlined. At a place like Yale, I think it's gone up by like maybe 50 seats over 20 years, something that's so insignificant compared to the increase in applications that it's almost laughable. And so because these enrollments have flatlined, the question you have to ask is, well, what explains that? You know, in any other business, the goal is to eat market share from your competitors. That's how you grow and become powerful. But when you look at a school like Harvard, they're not trying to open a new campus or a new location to compete with Yale. And Yale's not trying to open new campuses to compete with Harvard or with Stanford or with UChicago. These schools are very happy to divide up the geography the way it already has been and to just stay and keep everything as it is. And the logic behind this, the reason they don't want to grow is because they can jointly create this scarcity, prices for everyone will go up, which is why tuition inflation, especially at the elite schools, and remember I said there's a trickle-down effect for everyone else, especially at the elite schools, has gone up so, so, so dramatically. And the aspect of this that, you know, sometimes gets some media coverage, oftentimes doesn't, is because they've created a lot of this scarcity, not only are they jacking up prices on middle-class people and then fixing prices for financial aid for working-class people, what they're also doing is using this artificial scarcity to essentially blackmail billionaires to pay bribes in the form of donations to get their kids in. And so the entire business model is very corrupt and it's oriented around the scarcity. And the schools work together to enforce this scarcity through the cartel structure that they've set up. And so specifically what they've done is they've worked with the US News and World Report to create a rankings criteria, which incentivizes all of them, if they want to be ranked highly, to be as rejective, as selective as possible, and spend as much money per student as possible. And so when you combine those two things, the natural endpoint is a cartel where essentially enrollments are flat and spending increases all the time. It's the most inefficient way to organize this industry.
So this is really kind of eerie for me, because here we go. Let me see if I can pull one of these things up really quickly. So my audience knows, and we're using the language of cartel, which is very appropriate in this. My audience knows that my career's been as intelligence, and I'm an expert in human trafficking. So one of the things in that world is, how do you identify this? You have to have these elements, the acts, the means, and the purpose, and then for the specific purpose, which in this case is illicit market selling, and kind of child sex slavery or child forced worker slavery. But that middle column there with the means, it's force, fraud, and coercion. While you're laying this out, just like a cartel, and I can tell that you've done your research, which is awesome, but just like a transnational crime organization, it's not like a street gang. They run these things as businesses. One of the pillars in the business is having the means dialed in. And it sounds like the entire nature of this relationship is coercive. You said blackmail, which is a form of coercion. It sounds like that's exactly what's going on here. Now, of course, the end product is different. But this is not something that people would think of when they think college admissions, number of seats, what are the internal motivations of this university or college? But honestly, I'm seeing, as you're talking, I'm seeing a lot of overlap here between a regular or traditional crime organization, a cartel,
Right.
a mafia, something like that. And it's really fascinating.
What I think is really interesting about what you just said is I think a lot of times, we've gotten so used to this idea that seats are limited, that it is a zero-sum competition for resources amongst all of us against all of the others. And I think there's something deeply rooted in the human psyche about scarcity that activates when there's something we really want, and it feels scarce.
That's what
And
marketing and advertising is built off of, that scarcity. It's
right.
usually artificial, but it works.
Right. And what the schools have done, which I think is incredibly clever, is they've taken advantage of that to create these artificial divisions amongst people so they don't realize the actual market structural problems. And so I'll give you an example. Obviously, something that's gotten a lot of attention recently is how admissions are conducted at the elite colleges. Specifically, there are some in the Asian American community who believe that schools like Harvard discriminate against them in the admissions process. And I think the Supreme Court has made a judgment on that, and we'll be releasing that shortly. And so the question I always ask, though, is, well, what's the base problem? The base problem is there's so few seats that you can't have Asian Americans and Black African Americans who are able to enjoy the fruits of some of our higher educational institutions. Because they've created the scarcity, they're now, dividing Asians from Black people and essentially keeping us focused on these sort of cultural wars that aren't actually productive in terms of opening up more seats. The real solution here is abundance. It's not scarcity, it's abundance. And in other markets, you would expect to see more abundance over time, especially when it's so lucrative to be an elite college. But let me ask you a question. When was the last time you saw an elite college startup? I mean, basically, the last new elite college, I think, might have been UChicago in 1900 with John D. Rockefeller as its founder. I mean, it's been such a long time since there's been entry into this market because the schools, this cartel, has locked up all the relevant inputs. They foreclose anyone's ability to enter the market. They get massive subsidies. They make it hard to get accredited. And most importantly, they've colluded with the rankings in such a way that if you try to create a new and innovative school, you just wouldn't be ranked highly. And then no one would want to go because no one's going to want to take that first leap. And you can't establish a reputation in that way. And so, in all of these different anti-competitive monopolistic ways, the schools have completely locked up the market. And that's the fundamental problem, in my view. And they divide us with the culture war stuff. But in my telling, in my book, the thesis is essentially scarcity is the enemy, not our fellow man.
You know, it's really interesting about that point that you just made. And, you know, lots of Black listeners lean in, listen to this point that he just made. We are completely seized in this area as a society. The earliest Black American leaders were alive when these universities were being stood up, and there's nothing has happened since then. So we're talking Booker T. Washington, Frederick Douglass. We're talking 1860s to 1900. That's a long time ago. But you're right. I've never heard any of that last bit of what you said on any mainstream news. And actually, I've never even heard it on non-mainstream news shows like this and others. Really, really good point. There's so many ways. I'm looking at the clock. I'm looking at the questions. there's so many avenues to go down. But definitely, you know, maybe go back, rewind back 2 minutes and listen to that again and really think about the implications there, because it's absolutely true. Spot on. I am going to be making a clip of that and putting it on Twitter. So to get back to some of the business of it, these elite colleges and universities, they're private institutions, and somehow they've been allowed to consume massive amounts of taxpayer dollars. This idea is not going to leave me. It's just buzzing around in the back of my head now. Oh man. That's a really good point. I call it swept up in the passions of the day. And it was everything, from COVID, which is medicine, that turns into George Floyd, which is criminal justice, that turns into Black rights, which is civil rights, that turns into something about Asians, but I didn't know if they were being victimized or if they were being discriminated against. So that was kind of a question mark. So the ball just keeps getting passed around from here to there. And I'm thinking right about the college piece. I've never considered what you just laid out for us.
Well, you know, what's interesting about the college piece is, I mean, if we really think about it, this is not like some sort of consumer good. It's not even a status good. At its core, what education should be is just self-improvement, self-betterment. And I think that should be available to everyone, right? I mean, it's something that's so positive. It should be so positive. Of course, we want to live in a society where everyone gets the best education possible, where they're able to live up to the best of their ability and to contribute to their fellow citizens. And the way the colleges have structured this market does everything but, you know, it's no longer essentially about education. It's a lot about status and signaling. It's no longer about affordability. It's about exclusion and debt. And all of these things are so deeply perverted compared to if you think back to, you know, some of the founders of these schools and what they would have wanted.
Guys, 8 out of 10 Americans are completely dissatisfied with work, miserable, and they hate going into their job. This is a nut statistic. I can't believe so many people live that reality, especially since there are more jobs than people. That means it's actually easier for you to get into the career of your dreams, to get that dream job. This is something I can coach you through. No matter the company, the industry, no matter your education, qualifications, or experience. Guys, I've built a successful career in more than 5 different industries. I was always promoted ahead of my peers. I was always put in positions of more and more responsibility and leadership. This is something that I can help you achieve for yourself. Guys, you know and love me as the host of the Joe Mobley Show, and now we can have a one-on-one relationship with me as your career pivot coach. All you got to do is jump on a discovery call with me and see if this is the right move for you to make in 2023 and why this is the best time. Book that discovery call. Go to thejoemobleyshow.com/coach. That's thejoemobleyshow.com/coach. Book a time today. Guys, my time is limited. The spots are going to fill up, and then I'm not going to be able to coach you immediately. I'm going to have to put you on the wait list, but you're going to do the right thing. You're going to go to thejoemobleyshow.com/coach right now.
I think Ben Franklin would be ashamed with what UPenn has become. I think Hamilton would be somewhat ashamed with what Columbia has become. These are not institutions that are living up to the great traditions of their founding.
Oh, I agree. I have a lot of disagreements with Alexander Hamilton and economic policy, but I do think that I understand enough about the man to know that he wanted to build credit in such a way that brought authority or prominence or made a nation or state a serious contender in the global market.
Right.
There wasn't really a global market back then, but kind of the burgeonings of a global market. Now, I feel like debt is being used as a coercive tool and to crush down on the consumer and really to crush down again, but the tie-ins with transnational crime organizations who traffic in arms, drugs, and people is just blowing my mind right now because one of the keys to that is targeting a vulnerable population. And while we're 18 to 25, we feel invincible. We feel like we're at the prime of our life and we can take on the world. We're actually extremely vulnerable as we are building the foundation for our adult self, our professional self, and how we are kind of entering the market as an adult now, leaving mom and dad. And now I'm, the person, the establishment of the person going out into the world. This debt is crushing young Americans, and it follows them around. I mean, I don't know if you've ever listened to he was one of the Ramsey, Dave Ramsey personalities, young black dude. But he did a documentary called Stolen Future,
No, I
Borrowed
haven't. I'm
Future,
not familiar.
maybe. Well, there, I mean, there were all of these young adults and they're depressed. Many of them committed suicide or were suicidal, just thinking about their surmounting debt. And it's kind of because of this thing. Now they made the decision to take out loans. I get it. I had my wife and I had $93,000 of debt to pay off, which we did. Praise the Jesus. In 2000, we actually paid it off in 2020. But yeah, that's
Congratulations.
a thank you. That's a huge part of it. And the obvious question there is, we know why the colleges allow it to go on, but when you talk about this monopoly and you talk about this kind of coercive, exploitative relationship, why does Congress allow it to go on? Congress sees this monopoly. You and I aren't geniuses.
Right.
They see what these
Right.
few universities have done, and
Yeah.
they promote it.
The more I think about this exact question, the more cynical I become about Congress. My basic view at this point, essentially, is that in all of the areas of the economy that are more or less monopolized, so whether it's big pharma or the big Wall Street banks that precipitated 2008, when people aren't paying attention to some of these like market structures, when voters don't vote on a basis of reforming some of these markets, Congress just lets them get away with whatever they want because that's where the donations are coming from. That's where the lobbying dollars are spent. And consumers, citizens, they're not necessarily paying attention. And so if you're a median congressman, you're thinking about re-election. No one, if the mainstream media doesn't cover that you've just written an antitrust exemption for the schools and approved it for another 7 years, why wouldn't you do it? The financial incentive's certainly there. The donations are going to come in. It's going to maybe help your kid get into one of these colleges. There are all sorts of weird, perverted power dynamics here. But why wouldn't you do it? Until people start to take this problem seriously, not just in higher education, in my view, but also when it comes to Wall Street, also when it comes to big pharma, these markets aren't going to change. We pretend, I think, sometimes that we live in a free market system. We're very far from a free market system. A free market system is an open market where anyone can enter and meaningfully compete. In a lot of these industries, a lot of that's been foreclosed, either through regulatory capture and all sorts of regulations that make it impossible to enter, or through capture over inputs that are necessary to compete, or through the use of exclusive contracts, exclusive dealings. I mean, there's all these ways in which these really big players have figured out how to win in the first place and make sure no one else is even able to compete. And I think that's something that citizens need to start taking much more seriously because otherwise we're going to keep precipitating from bubble to bubble, from 2008 to now this higher education bubble, and who knows what comes next. And I think we're in a very dangerous position as a country unless we take this stuff on. And let me just add one point to that. You know, it's in our tradition to take on some of these monopoly markets. It's the Teddy Roosevelt tradition. It's the Woodrow Wilson tradition, the Louis Brandeis tradition. You know, there are ways both Republicans and Democrats have gone after monopoly power. You know, the Boston Tea Party itself was famously an anti-monopoly movement. It was against the British monopoly on tea. And I think there's this thread through the American ethos, which is very much for individual liberty, for open and free markets, for the right to compete, and is very, very averse to centralization of power in these bureaucracies, whether it's big business or big government. And I think, you know, we need to get back to that tradition because it's so important that we fix these problems now while we still have a chance.
Couldn't agree more. Guys, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the Joe Mobley Show. We are talking with Sahaj Sharda. He's the author of The College Cartel. It's available for purchase right now. Guys, there's an Amazon link below where you can get the book. Sahaj, we got to clear something up because I can already feel the emails, the comments. There are so many people listening to the show who are in college. There's so many parents and grandparents who are supporting college-bound and college-attending students. And there are people everywhere who desire to go, you know, to these elite institutions. I went to a middle of the pack. I went to Liberty for undergrad, but I wanted to go to a more prestigious university. I went to the George Washington University for my graduate degree. And for a long time, at the time, I'm in the Army, and I was seriously, seriously, seriously thinking about Brown and Cornell because of some programs that they have there. And they're very much the types of schools that you're talking about on the program. But I can feel all those listeners typing up their emails. Hold it. Hold the email. Just pause typing up their comments. Neither Sahaj or myself are calling for the removal of these institutions, but there needs to be a serious, timely effort for reforming these institutions. So talk to us about that idea some.
Yeah, look, I you know, I couldn't agree with the way you've just framed that question more. I went to Georgetown for undergrad, so I had a lot of friends at GW.
Oh, and I got you guys got ROTC down there.
And I go to Columbia Law School now. I'm actually in my dorm room at the university as I speak to you. So I am not one to say that students shouldn't go and seek out a higher education. That's not the point of this book. In fact, you know, my argument is actually the opposite. I think more people should be able to get a higher education at the very best institutions. My only point is that it should be more cost affordable and it should be accessible to more people. You know, what I don't want to declare war on higher education. I want to advance the mission of higher education. And I think it's really important to criticize the institutions you're a part of because that's the only way they can change and grow. You know, I remember when I was applying to law schools, I was telling one of my mentors about this book that I was writing. And he's like, well, don't include that on any of your applications. They're going to hate you. And, you know, obviously I toned it down a bit in my applications, but I did include it because I think it's really important for people inside these institutions to hear this argument. Because a lot of people don't even understand what they're doing. I mean, things become so automatic and so normalized that it's not even out of the norm to act in these monopolistic ways. You know, what's really funny to me is sort of the psychology inside a place like a Columbia or Georgetown, where, you know, if you're in the admissions office or you're in the president's office, what you're seeing is the number of applications increase every single year. You're increasing prices and people are willing to pay it every single year. Your endowment gets bigger every single year. They think everything's going great. And they don't think that there's something that they're doing which is harming the nation. And so I think it's really important to not only go to these schools, but so that we reform them to make them even better and to make this country even stronger.
So that kind of that kind of lays out that there is a value to these institutions. I agree. I agree completely. There are very few things that I am calling for, tearing down or dissolving completely. There are so many people that there are a lot of people that want to get rid of the Republican Party and start this party or that party. My neighbor's out here in his robe. Anyway, that is quite the distraction. I'll shoot him a text later and be like, thanks, bud. But no. We're not calling for the disillusionment of Ivy League schools, prestigious colleges and universities. Not at all. Now, one thing that this doesn't have to do with higher ed, the Federal Department of Education is another story. There seems to have been a direct correlation between the establishment of that department of government and a steep drop off on education outcomes. Well, that is a totally different episode. Let me drop this on your lap. I've been saying, and I'm not branding Sahaj a card carrying conservative here. This doesn't have to do with that. I've been saying for the longest time that there is probably alive right now a young man or woman between 15 and 30 who is going to reinvigorate certain areas of American thought, American philosophy, culture, American thought, what builds that up. William F. Buckley Jr. reinvigorated conservative thought, a huge pillar in American life, American thought. And the reason that he did it is because he wrote God and Men at Yale right when he graduated. It was kind of his review, his critique of the university, obviously Yale, and of the system and the higher education and the prestigious universities. And I could definitely see that because, I mean, this book is not that book. I can see you going forward and producing a really thoughtful, really timely, and really well-received critique of American higher education in the next 2 to 5 years. So just a thought, just something to put back there. I could get you hooked up with someone to write the foreword. But I'm glad that you left it on the application because it's something that needs to be talked about. And it's definitely something that you would have been a disservice to Columbia to kind of hide that from them. So we are closing out at the end. We got about 7 minutes left. I definitely want you to be able to talk about your book and where people can get it and what they can hope to find. But just, 3 or 4 minutes before that, just tell us something that we didn't get to that you really want the audience member to walk away with.
What I would really stress is the agency that people have to change these seemingly massive institutions and systems. I think it's often very much underestimated how much power individuals have over their own destiny in relation to things like this. I'll give you an example. I graduated in 2020 from Georgetown as an undergrad. My graduation was postponed because of COVID. So it happened in May of 2022. And one of the things I decided to do, I guess like sort of similar to the Columbia application, is I decided that I was gonna use this platform, use this stage to get this point across to the leadership at Georgetown. Famously, President Jack DeJoya there is one of the leaders of the price-fixing cartel. He organizes what's called the 568 Presidents Group, which is where these schools have historically colluded. And, so I decided to dress up as the Monopoly Man underneath my cap and gown and go on stage and say to President DeJoya that if he, even at this late stage, pulls out of the 568 cartel, things can change. The thing will fold up like a tent if he publicly pulls out and denounces the activities that were going on there. Look, I don't know how much of it got through. He kind of shook my hand and he's like, okay, keep it moving. It was kind of a funny protest of me in this Monopoly Man outfit on stage saying this to him and him basically saying, move along. But I do know that this year in 2022, The 568 President's Group was formally dissolved, in part because of the lawsuit that was filed in January 2020, in part because of protests like the one I did at Georgetown or the one I organized at Yale's graduation, which was a similar type of protest. When schools know that people are paying attention, they watch how they step much, much more. And I think this is true of congressmen and of senators. I think it's true of all sorts of domains. And so people need to pay attention. If you have thoughts, write about them, write to your congressperson, write to your senator. Even just that actually has much more of an impact than you think. These things do matter. And so what I would suggest is, you know, at the very least, pay attention and vote. There's so much that can be done, and there's so much that individuals can do. And so for anyone who thinks that this system needs to change, it's incumbent on you to help bring that change about.
Absolutely. I fully endorse that message. Sahaj Sharda, thanks so much for coming on the show. Tell people what they can hope to find in the book and where they can get it. And we will definitely have you back on when you're available.
Yeah, it would be great to be back on. So the book is called The College Cartel. It's going to be available on Amazon. What people can hope to find in this book is all sorts of anecdotes about how colleges have gotten more and more collusive over time, how the market structure has gotten more and more monopolistic over time. You know, some really, frankly, shocking things that are all in the public record. They're just not reported on. Things that are from, you know, essentially the floor of the Senate and the House, things that are from court documents that are all publicly available, and yet have never been weaved together in what to me is frankly the only story worth covering when it comes to colleges, or at least the primary story, because all the downstream problems, things like Varsity Blues, which I also cover in the book, or things like, you know, the culture war around affirmative action, which I also cover in the book, all of those things are coming from a place of scarcity in the first place. That's why there's so much corruption, and that's why there's so much cultural clash. In a world of abundance, a lot of those things are ameliorated, and I think America is much stronger for it. So that's the hope of the book. I also talk about some solutions on how to break up this cartel, how to stop them from colluding, and how to facilitate entry of new free market competitors into the marketplace.
Awesome. Well, look, I can't wait to get the book and read it, guys. It's Sahaj Sharda's The College Cartel. There is a link below. But here's the thing. It's March 23rd. This book giveaway for this month is already over. So when you go and you like and subscribe to this podcast, make sure you write a review. Tell us something that you enjoyed or learned, something that impacted you in this interview. If you leave a review like that, you will be entered in for April's book drawing. Guys, it's going to be a big surprise. It's going to be The College Cartel. I'm going to be mailing it out to one of you lucky listeners. But that's what you got to do to get in the drawing. You got to leave that review on any podcast platform. Tell us something that you learned about this interview. It is episode 193, or you can just mention Sahaj or The College Cartel. You know, I'll be able to figure it out. And you're in. Yeah. So, hey, thanks so much for coming on, guys. That's all we got. We will catch you in the next one.
Thank you, Joe. It was
now
great.
To him who is able to do immeasurably more than all we ask or imagine, according to his power that is at work within us, to him be the glory in the church and in Christ Jesus throughout all generations, forever and ever. Amen. If that was the first prayer you've ever prayed, I hope it won't be the last. Until next time, this is The Joe Mobley Show.